Laughing Eyes Kennel presents The Gypsy Musher with Iditarod and Yukon Quest veteran Hugh Neff. The Gypsy Musher will share stories from the trail, fortune-telling, and memories of mushing years past. Follow The Gypsy Musher on Twitter and visit our website at gypsymusher.com.
Hello and welcome, everybody. This is Robert Forto, hosting from Willow, Alaska. On the line, we have our host of The Gypsy Musher, Hugh Neff. Hugh, how's it going?
Oh, you know, one of those days. Had to jump a vehicle, had another vehicle stuck in a ditch, had to get pulled out. I had a phone call from a buddy's wife who they hit a moose on the way down to Glen Allen. So, you know, I guess we must be getting close to a full moon or something.
Either that or another day in Alaska. We were dealing with the same stuff here yesterday. It's about negative 20 here today in Willow. What's the weather like in Tok?
Oh, it's beautiful, man. It's only 15 below. And that's why, you know, when everybody makes fun of me for, why would you want to run dogs out in Tok? It's so cold there and there's no hills. And I just want to tell these people, you know, have you actually ever been to Tok? Because there's plenty of hills and typically, we're 10 to 20 degrees warmer here this year than Fairbanks, so it's been a nice, pleasant surprise. And we have so much snow here that the trees are literally starting to fall over sideways because they can't handle the overload of snow on them. So I'm hoping we get some wind in here soon because, you know, it's really not good for the forest.
Right, right. Well, you know, we've got plenty of snow down here. I know there's a lot of teams training up for the mid-distance races that are starting here this week with the Connect 200 and just about every weekend, pretty much leading up to mid-February. I know just last weekend you were involved in the Gin Gin race out towards, where is that exactly at, Hugh?
Oh, that starts in Myers Lake and goes through Paxson. You're on the Denali Highway, head up to McLaren, then you jump down on the Big Sioux and the McLaren River as well, and then you head back up to Alpine Lodge, and then you're just following the road back into Paxson. And it was a very enjoyable race. I was a little bit wiped out. You know, I'd been on the road for 10 days and had barely been sleeping at all, and had to take a 5-hour energy shot at the starting line just to stay awake. I mean, I was pretty wiped out, but it was nice knowing that I had a team waiting at the starting line that was ready to have some fun. And we got hit right off the bat. I mean, we had coming by my buddy John Chandelmeyer's place, you know, on PEX, and just, you know, 10 miles into this 200-mile easy little training race, we're hit with, you know, 30, 40-mile-an-hour winds, you know, socking it right into your face trying to cut across the lake, and there's 7-8 teams out there all trying to get across, you know, and a bit of a quagmire. But it was a good workout. It was sort of tough for me looking at the over. I don't just look at, you know, Hugh Neff and what my kennel's about, because that's, you know, all mushers should you look out for, you know, their dogs and all that, but we should all look out for the health of the sport as well. And it was a little bit disappointing to see a lot of teams drop out of such a, you know, relatively short race. And a lot of that was Mother Nature, but hopefully those folks that weren't able to continue on in the race for various reasons will persevere and keep on plugging away, because we all get put in our place as humans when you're out in the wilds. But, you know, at least I try to look at everything as a learning experience and try to, you know, press on from there. But it was a heck of a race and a lot of fun, and the level of community support and the lodges, how they took care of the mushers, it was nice to see.
So do you know how many guys entered the race there, Hugh?
Well, you know, there's two separate classes, the Gin Gin. Fellas, I'd say there's probably right around a dozen, maybe. I'm just totally off the top of my head. And that was a lot of my reasoning for doing that race, to be quite honest. I wanted to be in a mellow field. I didn't want to be around a million mushers and lots of dogs. I wanted an atmosphere where I could train my younger dogs at a more comfortable level. Just seeing the mushers that had signed up, good buddies with Brent Sass and a guy like Paul Gebhardt, I really enjoy being around, because Paul's very open about sharing knowledge and he's a very likable fellow and all that. So it was a great field of folks to hang out with. Doesn't get as much notoriety as those big purse races, perhaps, and it's not as old as them either, say the Cusco or the Kobuk or what have you, but still a nice, real good quality 200-mile race with some just incredible views. And this year it was a lot of interesting terrain to cover as far as open water and stuff like that. So it was not the easiest 200 miles in the world, that's for sure.
So I know in the women's field in that race, they do a mass start. Do they do a mass start with the guys too?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Right there at Myers Lake, and it was fun. Jesse was running some of his dogs and then a lot of my youngsters, and then I had my dogs as well as some youngsters, as well as veterans, and we just shot off right out of the parking lot. I had my buddy Jake Berkowitz was with a bunch of teams, Trent and Matt Giblin. They were all taken off at the same time. And there's a bunch of folks that were down on the little pond there by Myers that where the official starting line was. But John Schandelmeyer said we could all start, you know, if it was easier to hook off to a truck than go for it that way. You know, dog safety first. But there were a couple teams that were having problems getting out in front of us. And I literally, in the beginning of my race, had to jump off my sled, which you don't really tend to do very often, and run the team around another team that was stuck, you know, in some deep, puffy snow. So that was a great way to start off the race. But we had, you know, not only the winds and the deep snow, you had overflow and spots, nothing too major, but good training for the dogs, you know, a little bit of ice for them to go through is always going to be a good test for them because they're going to see it in a 1,000-mile race guaranteed. Hills, you know, plenty of good hills on the Denali Highway. And I was quite impressed with the dogs. That's probably going to be the only mid-distance race I'm actually going to be doing with them this year just for financial reasons as well as time constraints as far as getting everything prepared properly for the big races. So I was definitely surprised, you know, all the dogs finished and did well, and had a couple surprise dogs, which you tend to see in races, and that was nice too. But it was definitely a workout, that's for sure. So I was a little bit sick for most of the race, and right now I'm just trying to recover a little bit. I got a pretty bad sinus infection.
One more question about that mass start, if I can, because I know a lot of mushers, they don't typically enter things like that. You know, typically it's the two-minute interval between starts and things like that. How does a musher train for something like that if that's not what they and their dogs are used to, just running off and, you know, kind of starting off in a group like that? Can you give some tips or advice on how to best, you know, start with 10 or 15 teams there with your dogs all at once?
Yeah, this race was a little bit more spread out. Like, there weren't, like, a million teams that were all right next to each other, say, like you have in the Kobuk 440, where that's a genuine mass start where everybody's just shooting out for the one trail all at the same time. But if you know, if you think your dogs aren't going to be able to handle the situation and might get spooked, you can always just stay on the break and leave a couple minutes later. It's not like you have to get out there in the lead. And in fact, those people that tend to go for the front of these races, not really a great idea, actually. But, you know, just once the starter gun or once the whistle or the flag or the hand drops, you know, it's pretty much instinct. Those dogs tend to go for it. And I was right behind who was in there? Louis Ambrose, my buddy from St. Michael, and Jesse Holmes was there, of course, and Brent Gebhardt. The ladies had taken off a half hour before us, but because of the way the Mother Nature was on the lake there outside of John Schandelmeyer's place, it was whipping up real good. And so a lot of them were actually stuck there, about three or four teams. So we could see them all having issues trying to get their dogs across the lake. And we generally caught up to them and got around them, and they one at a time started following in behind us. So it was definitely an experience for everybody to you know, sort of laugh about afterwards. When you're going through it, it ain't much fun. But once you get through these situations, you sort of look back and chuckle on it a little bit because You know, you go into a race like a 200-miler thinking, it's just a little fun run, getting the dogs all prepped up. And you don't realize that in Alaska, 2 miles can take an hour sometimes, you know, if the trail conditions are tough enough. So it was one of those instances where you don't take for granted, you know, any moment, and you always need to be prepared.
So in today's world, everybody is following races like the Gin Gin and the Kinnick 200 and the Iditarod, of course, on social media, especially Facebook. And these days they're using the spot trackers. I know a lot of you guys carry those, and you guys had them on the Gin Gin race. How do you think that that helps the sport today versus back in the day where they had to do it from the newspaper or the internet, where they can literally follow their favorite mushers or their favorite teams right there on social media? How do you think that's helping out the sport?
It's a catch-22, you know. Right now, it's a little still in its infancy. Iditarod Quest, I've only been doing it for a few years now, and these smaller races are getting into it too, and it's not always going to turn out perfect. You know, the batteries might go off, or, you know, something might be wrong with the beacon. So that's going to take a while to tweak and try to perfect, and that being said, it's not always going to be perfect. What I'm sort of concerned about is how people are reading into situations. They're formulating what's happening out in the trail from their computer in some city somewhere on the other side of the world, and they're coming up with scenarios and stories and basically fabricating situations that just aren't happening out there, and it's affecting the tone of how people are getting along with each other. And I didn't even know what was going on in the Gin Gin race, but there was, I guess, some nastiness happening on the internet that, you know, this sport should be about celebrating and about enjoying a sacred lifestyle that we're blessed to have up here. And when it becomes all about racing and about bickering and, you know, negative energy, it just doesn't make sense to me. I just don't understand it. And hopefully folks who are like this, you know, keep their issues private and maybe can message each other. But when you throw it out in the public forum and you have issues often with people that date back years and don't have to do with just a certain race, then it's really not good for the overall health of our sport and lifestyle. So I just hope in the future, if there's problems with races or people are having differences of opinion, that it doesn't turn nasty, and that in the long run, what we should all be about is honoring the dogs that we're so lucky to get out there and play with every day.
That's a great point. I'm glad you brought that up, because I thought the same thing. You often see a lot of that, especially during Iditarod. You know, they're formulating, okay, Martin is only 4 minutes back from so-and-so, or something's happening to Lance, and then they go into this huge story, and they don't know what's going on. They're just seeing a little dot on the screen that says we're Musher is compared to the others. It's not always the case. They might just be resting or camping or you know, taking a break. It isn't necessarily a life or death decision of what's going on the internet. So I'm glad you brought that up. So let's get back to the dogs just a little bit here on the Gin Gin race. How did your dogs perform overall in terms of your expectations going into the race? I know you said it's only a 200-miler, but like you said, 200-milers can turn into a nightmare very quickly. So how did you think your dogs responded overall compared to how you thought they would do when they started the race?
Well, considering I hadn't been on a sled in nearly a couple of weeks and Jesse had been running them little 20-mile fun runs around Toke, I figured their stamina might be a little bit lacking after, you know, 3 or 4 hours. They did quite well, though. I had Jewel up in lead with Walter, and then I was rotating in Delilah. And I had, like, a bunch of dogs that had never raced before. Half my team I had never even been in a race with before. So I had a few of John Baker's dogs that I got. They're a little bit older that I figured would do okay, Gringo and Sport. And then Goldie and Sylvester are two of my younger yearlings and two-year-olds now. But they did quite well. For me, it was more not just about training them on the hills. It was more the mental aspect of dealing with overflow situations, other dog teams, and camping out. that's why in the back of my mind, I wasn't really planning on, you know, winning the race or going for it all. I was just out there training them more than anything. So I planned on taking a decent sized rest at McLaren, which wasn't a required rest break. All the front runners went through there, and we stayed there for about 6.5 hours. So looking back on the run rest schedules, from what you can sort of tell, those folks, when they camped out on the river, they only stayed for about 3.5 hours at most. So we got a decent, extra 2.5-3 hours of rest on them. And considering, you know, we weren't that far back at the finish, I was quite pleased with our pace. And that was what I was looking for. I wanted a nice team that was going to be coming in looking strong, and they definitely performed well. The final 70-mile run-in from Alpine in, we all had required 8-hour break at Alpine. But it just didn't make sense to me to be throwing on a huge run. I wanted them to have lots of rest. That being said, I definitely think I probably needed the rest more than they did after just getting off the plane. I basically got off the plane about midnight, went over to Millennium where my truck was at, grabbed my truck, drove all the way to Paxson, and within a couple hours was on a sled doing a race. So I was still on Milwaukee time.
one final question on Gen Gen, then I want to talk about the food drops that you're prepping for the quest and things. What is a typical runtime expectation for you in a 200-mile race? Is it a day and a half? What are we looking at in a 200-mile race, Hugh?
Yeah, like I said earlier, it's when you start trying to do that, you're just playing with yourself, because you're not really taking into account what the weather's going to be like and all that. But usually for 200 miles, yeah. So we had 14 hours of rest, and my speeds, I would say, would be anywhere between 8 and 10 miles an hour. So I'll let you calculate that out. But for me, I'm not calculating, I'm not a very scientific person. I'm more of a person who plays everything by feel and instinct, and I'm just looking for a team that's moving at a nice solid gait. And in a longer race, if they're not moving at a nice solid gait, that's when it behooves you to pull over and give them a break, even if it's only a half hour or 45 minutes. But in a race of such a short distance like this 200 miler, you give them a half hour, hour break somewhere along the trail, and you're going to be behind everybody else, because the people that are actually racing mid-distance, they're not going to be wasting, more than a minute or two out there on the trail. They're going to, these races can come down to seconds at times. But for myself, I didn't really come to Alaska. My big goal wasn't to, win some mid-distance race. I've always been about trying to do well in the bigger races. So that's where my focus is.
Well, the reason I ask you is leading into the next segment in these food drops and things that you're prepping for races. If you're planning on a day and a half, 2 days on the trail, you're packing certain things in your sled. And this is more of a question for our more novice mushers, talking about snacks and things that you're carrying along. How does that play into your preparation for a race, whether it be a 200 miler or a 1,000 miler, on how you begin to prep for things, whether it's snacks in your sled or the amount of food that you're going to drop at checkpoint A or checkpoint B? How does that go into play as you're planning for the race, whether it's a 200 miler or a 1,000 miler?
Well, yeah, good question. Definitely novice mushers, and pretty much any musher really, always send out a lot more stuff than you need. You know what? If you don't need it all, you're doing a good deed, because all that stuff's going to be going to local villagers or folks in the area that need, that have dogs. And that's the beauty of races like the Quest or Iditarod. You get to maybe spread the wealth a little bit to some of these folks that maybe can't afford all this high-priced dog food that a lot of the top mushers use. But as far as on the trail, it's interesting talking to different mushers. Everybody has different viewpoints about snacking now, how far, how long. Some folks will say you don't need to snack for 4 or 5 hours, and if it's a shorter race, where other folks are snacking every couple hours, because they're worried about the food going through the dog system and actually slowing, the team down, which it will. And it does depend, on how much you're snacking with as well. We all look at, you know, how we care for our dogs differently. I prefer to, if I'm going to err, I'm going to err on the side of caution, and I'm going to over-snack. And, you know, maybe it'll slow me down in the long run, but I would much rather have a team with some meat on it, you know, looking, you know, thick bodies, you know, 300-400 miles into a race than a skinny dog team, that's for sure. And what I would caution the newcomers with is just always have, you know, more food than you think you need, because these dogs' bodies definitely demand a lot of calories. And you have to be prepared for all types of circumstances. You got to have those dog jackets for the wind, your first aid kit, you as well. You should have, I carry three different headlamps, you know. Small, they don't weigh that much, but you never know when stuff's going to break down. And you should have hose clamps, wire. You know, you have to prepare for, you know, rough times out there, because, you know, you never know when you might get dumped in the drink or have to get a fire going. It's always good, you know, keep a knife and match and stuff like that on your body, too, in case you lose your dog team. I mean, John Chandemeyer had a great point in the race this year. He said, you know what, I don't know if it's such a good idea to be keeping these beacons on the sleds. It might make more sense to actually keep the beacon on the human. So we actually, a lot of us kept our beacons in our pockets just in case something happened and we got separated from our dog teams. And
I'm sorry, Hugh. Go ahead.
What happened, one of the trail breakers actually got caught in some overflow and got their snow machine stuck and actually had to use one of the other mushers, I believe it was Christy Barrington's beacon, to signal the Jinjin folks that there's an emergency situation. And it worked. I mean, they went out there with their snow machines and they got this guy back to the, you know, warmer environment and dried out, and then they went back and got the snow machine later. So there's safety issues that are great with these beacons as well. They are definitely an advantage as far as keeping an eye out on everybody out there.
And that's what I was going to say. Does that happen very often? And that's exactly what those are designed for. They're not designed to follow people on races on the internet. They are a life-saving tool. You press one button and pretty much the National Guard will come out looking for you. Isn't that right?
It depends on which type of device you use. But, yeah, there are definitely ones like that. We are warned before races that, you know, you have to be careful about pressing them, because they, you know, they're going to draw a lot of attention to you. So if you do happen to implement your device, typically you are officially out of the race from that point on. But in a situation like this with Christy, she and Paul, when they came across this person, they were helping the person out. So obviously everybody understood why they're doing that.
Right. So you said that you wanted to talk about prepping for the Yukon Quest. I know that's almost a month and a half away or so, and you're already starting preparations. Is that typical for a long distance musher to prep this far in advance, or what is the process for guys that have no idea what you're talking about when you say you're prepping for a race a month and a half in advance? What does that mean exactly?
Well, actually, the race is about a month away now. Basically, you know, you got to get out the saw and start cutting up all your meats and fish and fat and starting to bag your kibble, get all your booties together, all your, you know, different creams and ointments for the dogs, your different personal food. There's a whole lot of work that goes into it. And usually I'm done with all this by now. And I bet you there's probably a few people that are in the Quest that are done with their food drops by now. But because I'm doing school tours now before Christmas, I didn't have that general time frame that I usually have to take care of this. So that's why I'm a week or two behind schedule here. But having done, you know, so much race in the last decade, I realized that I don't necessarily need to be running all over Alaska doing all these mid-distance races, where it probably makes more sense for me just to be more organized for the Quest and Iditarod and get that all taken care of now. So I'm not only am I doing my Quest food drops, I'm doing my Iditarod ones as well right now at the same time. So But so yeah, you're not going to get it all done in one day. There's a lot of cutting up of meat. You got to take your 50-pound blocks of meat and cut it up into small little Snicker-sized pieces. And just the more organized you are, obviously, the easier it is going to it will be to prepare your meals on the trail.
Do you use a electric bandsaw type saw, or are you using a handsaw for that?
I use like a table saw.
Because I know that a lot of folks, have those really fancy food prep type bandsaws that they use. I know Vern Halter right up the street has a real fancy one that we use from time to time to cut up our meat. And I've seen people that are doing it with an axe, sitting there, on the floor cutting it up with an axe. So it's always interesting to find out how other guys are doing it too. So when you say Snicker-sized pieces, go ahead, Hugh.
Yeah, there's all different types of saws and stuff to use. I remember my buddy Timmy Osmar, he used to have like a little party there where Charlie Champagne would have all the stuff all pre-cut for Timmy, and he'd invite a bunch of his buddies over there in Nunilchik, and they'd just get out there and they'd have his food jobs done in like 3 hours. I mean, but Timmy, has done probably close to 30,000 milers, so he had it down to a science. And that's, I think, a little bit of an advantage of having done so many races is that you know when you've got the right amount of stuff and all that.
You said that you cut it up into Snicker-sized pieces. Is that easier to carry? Is it easier to melt in the cooker? What is the preference for those small of pieces?
Snacking, You just walk down the team. If you're going to throw at the dog a 5-pound piece of, beef compared to a little dinky, Snickers bar, they're going to be able to chew up that Snickers bar a lot easier. It's going to burn off a lot less energy on their part chewing it, where if you give them a big piece, first of all, most of the dogs are just going to look at it like, especially if it's more of a girl dog, they're just going to look at it like, I ain't dealing with that, They want you to take care of them, so you have to, you're almost like a cook and a waiter for them. You have to make sure everything's to their liking, because if, your dogs aren't chewing and they're not consuming, then they're probably not going to be going very far, so everybody thinks it's all about, miles that you're training them and stuff like that, but it's really about the whole overall care of your team, not only their bodies, but, how you're feeding them, too.
Right, and
a lot
going
of
up and down.
We're not just – we're soaking a lot of kibble as well. I use Red Paw, and that's a lot of how they're getting their nutrients and their H2O on the trail. And a lot of it, they're just chewing snow, too. It's the funny thing about sprint mushing compared to long distance and sprint mushing, they don't allow chewing on trail because that's going to snow. Chewing snow on the trail, that'll slow their teams down. But in long distance, if my dogs are chewing snow, I'm happy.
And the reason I brought that up, Hugh, about the Snicker bars is a lot of people that don't know much about the sport don't understand what a snack is. People think, okay, well, we're going to give them some dog treats or something of that nature, but it's actually just the same, pretty much the same food that they're eating on a daily basis, whether it be fat or meat or fish or whatever you're feeding as a snack, depending on the conditions. That's the snack, isn't it?
Oh, yeah, and it's not just one little Snickers bar. You're going to give them a few pieces depending on the dog's size and, how much, what time of day it is, the weather. There's so many variables that are involved. And for all the folks listening at home with your pet dogs and everything, it's like I tell everybody, you got to realize these aren't just dogs. These are dogs, and there's a difference. And these aren't just your average little foo-foo that you let out in the backyard to tinkle and then bring them back inside. These are animals that are expending a lot of energy out there. They're eating close to, 10, 12,000 calories. That's over 25 Big Macs a day on the trail. But obviously we're feeding a lot better food than what you're going to get at a fast food place. We're feeding quality meats at, $3,000, $5,000 worth of food just goes into a 10-day race. And they might not eat all that food, but you're going to have that food ready for them just in case. You don't know if you get caught in a storm out there. You might be stuck at a checkpoint for a few days or if a virus goes through your team and you have to wait it out. I mean, you have to plan for a lot of different situations out there.
So when you're finished cutting up your food and fixing up your drop bags for the Yukon Quest and the Iditarod, what happens next? Tell our listeners what goes on in the process after you're finished.
Oh, well, then you just celebrate being done with it. Because believe me, that's the toughest part of racing for most of us is just the preparation, you know. It's almost, I don't know what to compare it to, but it's a lot of stress, and it's not super difficult to do if you've done it a lot and if you've got a few friends helping you out. But it's definitely something you have to get done with. You're fairly well aware of this, and I'm sure everybody in their unique worlds has the same issues. It's procrastinating. You can't let stuff go to the minute, last minute. That's when you usually get in trouble. If I had my high school and college years to do over with again, you know what? I wouldn't have waited until the night before the test to study or to hand in my book report. I would have had that book report done 3 or 4 days beforehand, and then I would have redone it again. Because I think a lot of us just procrastinate until the last minute instead of getting out there and getting it done. Then when you get it done, then you go train dogs again. So
right.
It's almost like you have to have a give and take there. And fortunately for me, I'm pretty well know, who my main dogs are, and I've got a lot of veterans, and that helps. So I'm more concerned with just being totally prepared for the races this year. And maybe I'll do some more mid-distance races after in the spring. But for right now, I don't think the way my body's feeling and, being sick and everything, I don't think it's very smart on my part to be running around doing a bunch of races right now.
So my question was, besides partying after the food drops are done, what happens to the bags? Tell our listeners that.
Oh, okay. Yeah, well,
blown around
for
Iditarod,
they actually have two different drop-offs, one in Fairbanks, another in Anchorage, where you can bring them to. Usually get a buddy. My buddy Sam did it for us last year, and he was very nice about doing that, and he dropped it off. And then for the Quest, there's a spot in Fairbanks, and then another spot in Whitehorse where you can drop them off at. And you take them down there either in the back of your pickup or on a trailer. And typically, the Quest having, a third the number of food drops, checkpoints, you're going to have a lot less bags. So I can't remember offhand, but maybe 25 or 30. Where the Iditarod, you're going to have a lot more bags. Not as much in your bags, though. But you will. There's a minimum, I think, believe 60 pounds per checkpoint for Iditarod. But there's so many different checkpoints that you don't overload it. Where with the Quest, you can put a bit more in your bags, or have more bags per checkpoint because your handlers are going to be going along the route and they can just pick up whatever extra stuff you have.
And I know that it's been an issue in the past. Maybe it's been an issue with you, and you could share some experience about that. But what about spoilage on these long-distance races where you get there and, it's gotten too warm and your meat has thawed and become rancid or whatever? What happens then? Have you had an experience like that?
Somewhat, yeah. Back in the early days, if you use a lot of game meat, you could definitely have problems with that. I remember Lance had that issue a couple of years ago, and I did a run. He had to basically feed kibble the whole time, Red Paw, and he still won the race. So it's doable to just feed kibble. I wouldn't really suggest it, but sometimes, in tough situations, you just got to deal with what you have available. Some folks, instead of cutting up all their meat into tiny little pieces, will keep some of it in 5 to 10 pound blocks. So if the weather does get warm, you could peel off the outer layer. You can use the inner core that might still be frozen. But then again, you still got to worry about bacteria and dogs getting sick off that type of food. In the past, people were using freeze-dried stuff. I don't know if that was necessarily as good for the dogs. I haven't even seen many people use freeze-dried stuff anymore, to tell you the truth. But yeah, there's definitely there can be issues with meats and fish and stuff like that. So that's why you should always have a decent amount of kibble in your drop bags.
So on our last segment, Hugh, we have about 10 minutes left. We wanted to do our sled dog showcase, and today you talk about Princess. Let's talk about her a little bit.
Well, it was really neat after I did her last year. I've always wanted to go to Teller and, you know, visit one of my heroes, Joe Garney, who it's like a lot of these folks. He might not be an Iditarod champion, but, you know, Joe Garney, Paul Gebhardt, Ed Eaton, I can name a whole bunch of other fellows that came in second or third in the big races. And you know what? They're just as great a champion to me than, you know, some 4 or 5-time Iditarod champion. Just because you don't win the race doesn't make you a winner in my book. And so, you know, for me, Joe Garney's a legend. And to go up there and see his beautiful dog yard and to have the honor of him actually selling me a dog, it was an amazing experience. I went up there with my buddy Mike Williams, who's a revered elder from the Kuskokwim region. And to hang out with those two guys, it was like hanging out with a bunch of shaman. And to get Princess from Joe, she's not going to be a superstar dog. I basically got her for breeding in the future. She ran in this race, and she did good. She was actually a leader for Harry Alexi, who had a team through the National Guard with Lance a couple years ago. And she's a princess. She's just happy all the time. That picture I posted yesterday on Facebook, she's the one jumping straight up in the air, all 4, you know, feet off the ground. And she's got that attitude, you know. She's always raring to go. She might not be the most steady dog, but she keeps a lot of the other dogs happy. And that's part of, you know, what you're looking for when you put your team together. They're not every dog's going to have the same temperament or the same gait, but if they have something in their character that's going to add to the overall strength of your team's, you know, personality, then I'm definitely going to take a second look at them and see, you know, well, maybe she'll be able to make the cut. I'm probably not going to use her in the Quest. I'll be saving her for Iditarod. And even though she was a leader with Harry's team, I'll probably just have her, you know, in the team somewhere. I've got enough leaders as it is.
How old is Princess?
That's debatable, but I'd say probably 5, 6, somewhere in there. So
she's in the prime of
solid
of her,
age. You know, most long-distance dogs, you know, the way we race now, it's not about speed anymore. It's just about recovery time and smooth overall speed average. So, you know, I mean, look at Sebastian. He was running dogs all the way up until they were 10 and 11 and stuff. And I've had a few like that, but I think he proved that with a steady momentum that you can run older dogs if they're all, you know, if they all are cohesive as a unit. So I'm going to have, you know, Walter's my main Quest leader, and he's a 7-year-old, and he's looking as solid as ever. So I think dogs getting old is a little bit like humans getting old. If you allow your dog to want to be old, then they will be. And I see that in humans, too. If you want to be old, if you decide, okay, I'm old, then you're going to be old. But that ain't what my life's about. So 7-year-old dog ain't that old to me.
That's a great point. And what you mentioned that you wanted to use Princess for breeding. I know that this is a subject that a lot of mushers keep to their vest, so to speak. Do you typically wait until the dogs are nearing the end of their career to begin breeding, or do you just do it sporadically, you know, throughout the dog's lives?
Yeah, I would definitely say sporadically, and I would definitely say I'm not a person that looks to breed all the time either. I've guys, you know, that are considered friends that have been in the biz longer than me, come from very established mushing families that breed 3-4 litters a year. I'm lucky if I want to breed 1 litter a year. That's just not, I don't want to have a huge kennel. I like to keep the numbers low, anywhere between 35 and 50 dogs. And if you're going to do it that way, you really can't be breeding litters all the time. And as far as the age of the female, anywhere I'd say between 3 and 7 or 8 would probably be, you know, and 7 and 8 sort of pushing it as far as age goes. It'd probably be 3 and 6, maybe something like that. Most of my females, though, are spayed, as well as most of my boys are neutered, because I don't want to have a lot of accidental litters out there. And I do try to, you know, you do try to pick specific dogs to breed with. I didn't really know much about breeding until just, you know, asking questions and just talking to folks like Lance or Paul or whoever, and just realizing that a lot of what you're breeding for isn't necessarily how a dog runs. It's how it thinks and, you know, what its heart is all about. So, and as well as looking back at the lineage of the animal and seeing what their parents are like. Because it's like I tell all the kids in my school tours, you better be careful and keep an eye on your grandparents, because believe it or not, you're going to end up being a lot more like them than you are your parents usually. And I believe the same thing with dogs, too.
Yeah, that's a great point. And they always say with baldness and things like that, if your grandmother or your grandfather is bald, it's a pretty good chance you're going to be bald too. So I guess that comes with dogs as well, don't you think?
Well, it's not bald, the mushroom baseball cap effect.
All right, Hugh. So we have a couple minutes left. I know we're getting in the heart of mushing season. We started this show kind of in the off season at the beginning of October, so it's going to be a little crazy for a little while. What's coming up in some future shows? What do you want to talk about to our listeners over the next couple of months? Do you have any ideas?
The overall health and spirit of dog mushing, you know, it's growing in popularity because of the internet, but I think people that are getting into it, get into it for the dogs and not because you want so-and-so to win a race, you know. And I think all of us mushers would agree that I wouldn't want to see any people being against another musher because they were one of my main rivals. That's why, like my buddy John Larson Johnson, who helped me out with bringing dogs to the starting line this week. That's why we as mushers love this guy, because he's on the internet all the time promoting all the mushers and is about the whole, you know, fun of what the sport should be about. And if you really want to be about the sport, and I really would suggest going back and looking where it came from, not only the Iditarod, but the sweepstakes, the Alaska sweepstakes, and, you know, Googling it on the internet or renting some movies. I tell everybody, if you want to get the best mushroom movie ever, call up Iditarod. It's called Purely Alaskan, and I just love watching this movie. I watch it a couple times a week, and it's about the Iditarod from day one, and just seeing the whole overall evolution of dog mushing. And it's a great time for the sport. You know, we've got a lot of amazing new younger native kids that are really, Mike Williams is back, and Pete Kaiser, you got Josh Kadzow, Johnny Baker, you know, John won the race last year, and he's the obviously the person to go after this year if you want to make it to the top. But it's a cool time for our Iditarod. I think it's it's come full circle in a certain aspect, and what Joe Reddington, you know, started this race on, bringing the love of dogs and the sport to the villages, it's happening, and it's an exciting time to be a part of it. And whether I come in first or 10th place doesn't matter, as long as I'm, you know, one with the dogs and, you know, enjoying, you know, the loveliness of Alaska, who's to complain about anything?
Totally agree, and that's my focus with helping you out with this show, is to bring that showcase to the sport, not just talk about races and prize money and standings and all that. It is about the dogs and you know, the behind the scenes stuff of the sport is what I like to talk about, and that's part of being the Gypsy Musher, is to be able to tell some of those stories. It's not just about finishing first and, you know, making sure that your name is in the press every day. That's not my focus with this show, and I don't think it is with yours either. So Hugh, it's been a pleasure. We'll talk next week for sure. Look forward to hearing from you in the next coming days about what you want to talk about next. Anything else you want to add to close the show?
Yeah, no, just all my friends down in Connectville, have fun with the race this weekend. Wish I could have been there, and I'm sure it's going to be a fun race for all y'all, and I'll be busy cutting up meat, but I'll be keeping an eye on you guys on the internet.
There you go. So we'll talk next week. This is Hugh Neff. My name is Robert Forto, and you're talking to Hugh Neff, the host of the Gypsy Musher. We will make sure that we get a new show posted real quick so you can set your reminders. If not, follow us on Twitter or Facebook, and check out our website at dogworksradio.com. Hugh, talk to you very soon. It's been a pleasure.
All right, man. Keep an eye out for those moose on the road.
There you go. Take care. This is Robert Forto on behalf of Hugh Neff. Talk to you real soon. Goodbye.